We're looking this morning at the growing practice by U.S. airline companies, sending almost one of every five planes to be fixed to developing countries from Central America to Asia. They do that because it's cheaper. The industry says it's safe, but government investigations show that federal inspectors do not monitor the work properly. Yesterday, we went to a repair operation in El Salvador. Today, NPR's Daniel Zwerdling meets with mechanics in El Salvador, and they tell troubling stories about the planes you fly on.
The airplane repair company in El Salvador is called Aeroman. I asked to meet with executives and talk with some mechanics, see their repair shop firsthand. And the company said no, no, and no. So I tracked down mechanics on my own. I found them along the road, literally. Aeroman's based at the International Airport, about 40 minutes from the capital, and it sends buses to pick up its mechanics around the city.
How do you do, sir? Are you one of the airline mechanics at Aeroman? Do you speak English?
There were five mechanics waiting for the bus at this stop. They wore shiny ID tags, Aeroman, in big letters.
What sort of airlines have you worked on?
JetBlue.
America West,
JetBlue, U.S. Airways.
But they said Aeroman will fire them. If managers know, they talk to me. So we arranged to meet later at their homes. And you could say, well, these mechanics are just typical employees grumbling. Except their stories echo the problems that federal investigators found at other foreign repair companies. The first mechanic lives near a church. They were having a festival. As we talk, women walk by balancing baskets on their heads. The mechanic says Aeroman pays him about $7,000 per year. He's proud of his work. My interpreter is Senya Barahona.
It's a great responsibility, and our supervisors are constantly highlighting to us that our job is not a game. The life of 200, 250 people that are flying depends on us.
But the mechanic says managers keep pressuring them to fix the planes faster. For instance, there's rust on a metal beam, but it's just a little over tolerance.
The supervisor says, oh, just leave it like that. There's no need to repair it.
The Federal Aviation Administration says mechanics have to fix the planes exactly according to the airline's manuals. But the mechanics say supervisors tell them that takes too much time. All the mechanics, including this one, made me promise not to use their names.
Have you personally ever been pressured to do work that you thought was not 100% correct?
Last week, we were repairing the fuselage.
The way he tells the story, they had to replace some fasteners. They're like rivets. They're called Hilox. The manual says they had to use a kind of Hilox that's designed to withstand a specific amount of pressure on a specific part of the plane. But he says Aeroman didn't have the right Hilox on hand. So the supervisor said, use another kind.
That would cause actually a crack in the fuselage when there is turbulence.
So when the supervisor said to you, look, install these other parts, what did you say to him?
Que no.
I told him no, because the manual does not allow me to do that.
And then what did the supervisor say?
No, que lo instalara. To go ahead and install it, because we were in a hurry to turn around the airplane.
And I met with another mechanic, and he ticked off more problems at Aeroman. We talked outside the cinder block house where he lives with his parents. The mechanic says some employees at Aeroman don't store glues at the required temperature, and that potentially means that parts of the airplane could fall apart. And he says some workers can't even read the airline's repair manuals. They're all in English. Some mechanics at Aeroman can't read English. He can't. He also said he'll be fired if I use his name.
And what do the mechanics do who can't read English?
Then you have to ask for help with another colleague. And in my case, I ask for help often.
Now, in theory, U.S. government inspectors should catch these problems. The FAA has to inspect every repair shop that fixes American airplanes, in the U.S. or overseas. But the mechanics say inspections are a joke. Here's the first mechanic again.
FAA inspectors always tell them, I'm going to be there on this date. And obviously, logically, Aeroman will do everything it can to have everything ready. Then the FAA won't ever find anything.
And the Inspector General of the Transportation Department has discovered this is a widespread problem. In fact, FAA inspectors never even show up at some foreign repair stations for years. And partly as a result, FAA officials don't know if Aramon is worse or better than other repair companies. As I mentioned earlier, executives at Aramon wouldn't talk with me. And the only airline that talked about Aramon is U.S. Airways.
Actually, I was very impressed with the facility, having been to a number of heavy maintenance providers here in the U.S.
David Seymour is senior vice president. He's visited Aramon, and he says it's organized, clean. The mechanics seem well-trained. So I told him the stories the mechanics told me. Does that trouble you?
I don't know the people you talk to, and I don't know, does it raise concern of the comments that you heard? You know, without me being able to validate that, I'm not sure that I can draw a concern on anecdotal comments.
Seymour said, remember, it's been years since a U.S. airliner crashed because of maintenance mistakes. It was 2003, and the repair company that messed up that time was in the States. But some people who've been following the airline industry say the margin of safety is getting thinner.
That's a very scary thing.
Senator Claire McCaskill is the Democrat from Missouri. She wants Congress to force FAA to be tougher on foreign repair companies.
When you have a situation like this, where you're going to El Salvador because it's going to be a lot cheaper, and the company in El Salvador is going to make a lot more money if they can promise the planes out more quickly, then that is a dangerous stew that we are stirring.
Just a few weeks ago, U.S. Airways discovered a disturbing mistake at Aramon. Mechanics mixed up the wires in the cockpits of two Boeing 737s. The gauges that are supposed to show how the two engines are doing were crossed. So, if you were the pilot and the gauge showed an engine's in trouble, you might shut down the wrong engine. The vice president of U.S. Airways told me that a team has gone to El Salvador. They're investigating what went wrong. Daniel Zwerdling, NPR News.
Later today on All Things Considered, American Airlines has gone a different route, choosing to repair its planes here in the U.S.
Now to some of the latest medical advances in restoring eyesight. Millions of people in the U.S. have lost the ability to see from diseases that attack the retina. Now scientists say they have brought back some vision in people with retinal damage. One team did it using stem cells, another using electronics. NPR's John Hamilton has this story on research by both of those teams. It was presented in Chicago today at the annual meeting of the Society for Neuroscience.
Doctors have gotten pretty good at fixing problems with the cornea, where light enters the eye, and they're experts at replacing the lens, which focuses that light. But it's a different story with the retina, a layer of cells at the back of the eye that transforms images of the world into nerve impulses. Robert Aramont of the University of California, Irvine, says a patient with retinal damage doesn't have many options.
That is so terrible. A doctor can only say that you will probably be more and more blind, and you might be totally blind in 10, 15 years.
Since the 1980s, Aramont has been part of a team working to fix retinas damaged by diseases including macular degeneration and retinitis pigmentosa. And for several years now, the team has been treating patients using fetal retinal cells. Their approach is to retrieve an intact sheet of retinal cells and transplant that sheet into a damaged eye.
And these cells develop later on to the layers of a normal retina.
Aramont says they've treated just 10 patients so far because of funding constraints. But he says seven of those patients got better, including one woman whose vision went from 2800, which is nearly blind, to 2200, which is good enough to do most daily tasks.
And she improved her life considerably. She just could play a computer game, and she could write emails, she could write big letters of Reader's Digest, and she took up her hobby to paint ceramics.
A very different approach to restoring vision comes from scientists at a California firm called Second Sight Medical Products. Brian Meck, a vice president with a PhD in materials science, says the company has created a sort of bionic eye.
The subject wears a pair of glasses that has a video camera in them, and then we wirelessly transmit the video signal to an implant that sits on the eye. And that implant then talks to an array of electrodes that are inside the eye on the retina.
Those electrodes do what the old retina can't anymore, send electrical signals to the brain that allow sight. You can see an animation of how the device works at npr.org. Meck says it usually takes patients' brains a while to make sense of the new signals.
They learn to use the device better over time, so that someone that's had it for a year will do better than they did at 3 months.
The artificial eye replaces millions of retinal cells with just 60 electrodes. Meck says that means vision is rudimentary.
A very large percentage of people can find doors and move towards them, and a similarly large number can follow a line on a floor.
Meck says patients tend to get emotional when they realize they can see even a little bit.
A lot of crying, a lot of smiling, you know, it's a sensory input that they haven't had in a very long time, and so they're excited.
At the neuroscience meeting in Chicago, Second Sight presented a study showing that patients could tell which direction an object was moving. Also at the meeting, scientists presented studies showing ways to create new light-sensitive molecules in the eye and how to use stem cells to grow specific types of retinal cells. John Hamilton, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
In 1960, Jack Kerouac boarded a train and headed west. He was on the road again, this time to poet Lawrence Ferlinghetti's isolated cabin in Bixby Canyon, Big Sur. Jack Kerouac captured the 6 weeks he spent there, as he did with much of his life, in a novel, this one called Big Sur. A new documentary has artists trace that journey, including Tom Waits, John Ventimiglia, Patti Smith. The director of the film is Kurt Warden. He joined us along with Joyce Johnson, who's written a memoir of her time with Jack Kerouac. She was with him the day in 1957 that On the Road came out and made him an instant celebrity.
He had written that book in 1951. By the time he actually became famous, he was a very worn-down man, so it was a very fragile person indeed who had to deal with a sudden onslaught of fame.
But also he had fans, I mean, people he couldn't beat off, practically,
the
women
and
men.
The fans were very disturbing to him because they all wanted a piece of him. Suddenly everybody wanted to know him. Everybody was interpreting and misinterpreting his message. It was a lot for anyone to deal with, even if someone in really good shape, and Jack was not in good shape.
And drinking heavily.
And drinking heavily, yes.
Me drunk practically all the time to put on a jovial cap to keep up with all this. But finally realizing I was surrounded and outnumbered and had to get away to solitude again or die.
Now, he takes the Zephyr. That's the train that would take him all the way to San Francisco. And what did he hope to find in California?
I have this vision of him curled up in that little car on the train for this long journey cross country and trying to deal with who he is, where he is, and where he may be going. I think there's a realization that he's not that 20-year-old any longer on the road.
He always had this image of himself as a kind of guy living in a hut on a mountain all by himself in seclusion. And whenever he tried it, it didn't work for him. He was always safest when he was in transit. When he actually got someplace, it would all fall apart for him very quickly.
He doesn't go straight to this little cabin. He goes to San Francisco first, where you really get a sense of the seriousness of his alcoholism.
Jack did not necessarily live his life according to plan. And even though he had a plan to meet up with Lawrence and go directly to the cabin, he gets to town, he meets up with some old buddies, and he ends up drinking. And that turns into a couple of days. But eventually he gets his act together, and he gets down to Big Sur. Getting that act together is where we get the title of the film from, One Fast Mover, I'm Gone. And I think that's a statement that he makes, that if I don't do something and I don't get moving quickly, that I'm a goner.
Right. There's this sort of wonderful moment where you have Robert Hunter, lyricist for the Grateful Dead, reading this one little section of how he gets from San Francisco to Big Sur.
One fast move or I'm gone. So I blow $8
on a cab. To drive me down that coast. It's foggy night, though. Sometimes you can see the stars in the sky to the right where the sea is.
Well, when he, you know, got to Big Sur and had this idea of this cabin and solitude, and he was going to ring himself out, he does find this magical place.
You see one single flower nodding on a cliffside far across the canyon, or a huge knot in a redwood tree looking like Zeus's face, or some of God's little crazy creations goofing around in creek pools, zigzag bugs.
Zigzag bugs. And then you show in your film this very scenery, beautifully shot, and so powerful.
For this film to be successful, we had to hear Jack. We had to hear what he wrote. And the images, I feel, had to be very simple. And they had to allow the viewer to listen. By listening, you really get the sense of the beauty and the wonder and the detail, the color, the texture of how Jack wrote. But we know it very quickly. It turns to a very dark perspective on the Bixby Canyon where he is.
Well, there is this moment where what had been a joyous, maybe you might even say childlike experience, turns into what sounds like a nightmare.
When I went to the sea in the afternoon and suddenly took a huge, deep yogic breath to get all that good sea air in me, but somehow just got an overdose of iodine or of evil, maybe the sea caves, maybe the seaweed cities, something, my heart suddenly beating, thinking I'm going to get the local vibrations. Instead, here I am almost fainting, only it isn't an ecstatic swoon by St. Francis.
I think he's realizing at this point that he needs to be around people and he needs to be around his friends and be in another place than this canyon.
But he can't be around people either. You know, he could not find balance in his life. He was always split in so many ways.
After this great sense of him breaking down and reaching these frightening depths, the book ends with a passage that is read here by musicians Patti Smith and Dar Williams. It's his saying goodbye to Big Sur, realizing he can't, this is not the world that he can live in.
I'll stay with Ferlin Getty at his home a few days, and he'll smile and show me to be happy for a while. And we'll drink dry wine instead of sweet and have quiet evenings in his home.
I'll get my ticket and say goodbye on a flower day and leave all San Francisco behind and go back home across autumn America, and it'll be, awesome. I mean, it's just, and it'll, that's so nice.
As though part of the sort of sweet sadness of listening to this last passage, that we know that Jack Kerouac did die what we would consider young, at 47.
In 1969, yeah.
The end of the novel, there is some sort of revelation of life.
Which, if it happened, was a passing feeling.
Yeah, but he had it for that moment.
He had it for that moment.
The sea seems to yell at me, go to your desire and don't hang around here. For, after all, the sea must be like God. God isn't asking us to mope and suffer and sit by the sea in the cold of midnight for the sake of writing down useless sounds. He gave us the tools of self-reliance, after all, to make it straight through bad life mortality toward paradise, maybe. I hope.
The documentary One Fast Move or I'm Gone, Kerouac's Big Sur, is available today on DVD. We heard from director Kurt Warden and Kerouac biographer Joyce Johnson. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block in California.
And I'm Michelle Norris in Washington, D.C. And now to the world of running. Last weekend's Detroit Free Press Flagstar Bank Marathon started out uneventfully. About 9,000 runners lined up under clear skies to participate in the 32nd annual race. But by the end of the day, the event was overshadowed by tragedy. In the span of just 16 minutes, three male runners, ages 26, 36, and 65, collapsed and died while running in the 13.1-mile half marathon. The autopsies were inconclusive. A few weeks ago, two other runners died in a San Jose, California half marathon, and a 23-year-old marathoner collapsed and died in Baltimore earlier this month. The recent string of deaths raises questions about the strain that long-distance running puts on the body and the lack of preparation by some runners. To talk about this, we're joined now by Dr. E. Lee Rice. He's the medical director of the San Diego Rock and Roll Marathon and the Life Wellness Institute. He joins us now from San Diego. Doctor, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Statistics suggest that there's been quite an increase in the number of people who are participating in marathons and half marathons. What kinds of questions does that raise about training and preparation and even liability?
I think it raises a ton of questions, actually, about all those things. Statistically, in 1976, there were approximately 25,000 marathon runners. And in 2008, the latest statistics are approximately 425,000. The average running history of the average runner has significantly changed. And with that comes the question of, are these people really fit and trained well enough to safely run a marathon?
What kind of strain does a marathon put on the body?
It's not unusual for marathon runners, people who run for more than 3 hours at a time, to have some blood markers that show that there is some inflammation or irritation caused to the heart muscle itself. So it's often not so much what we do as how we do it. And if people are running beyond their capability, which means beyond their level of training and their body's ability to adapt to that level of strenuousness, then there can be muscle breakdown, cellular injury, or even death, and complications that go along with that.
What kinds of things lead to the deaths of these marathoners? Are we talking about cardiac arrest, too much fluid, too much heat?
Cardiac problems break down into younger runners and older runners. In older runners, meaning probably over the age of 50, the greatest cause of death while running is cardiac disease. For younger runners who die, it usually is some yet undiscovered congenital abnormality in their heart, either hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which is an enlargement of the heart muscle itself, or some change in the normal placement of the coronary arteries themselves. And those things are not normally detected in a typical examination, and the athletes generally are totally unaware that they even exist. The other thing that can happen in running is what we call dilutional hyponatremia, basically water intoxication. And that intake of water actually surpasses their body's sweating capability, and then they get their sodium diluted, and that loss of sodium concentration in the cells actually causes a potentially fatal cardiac arrhythmia. I think the bottom line for most runners is that they are their own very best gauge of what's strenuous for them and what's not. And unless they pay attention to their bodies and they train to allow their bodies to adapt to the running condition before they really go for it and try and get to do a personal best in a time, then there will potentially be some dangers.
Dr. E. Lee Rice is the medical director of the San Diego Rock and Roll Marathon and the Life Wellness Institute. Doctor, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
And if you're thinking of running a marathon, you can find some advice from Dr. Rice on our website. That's at npr.org.
And the real estate bust has struck some working-class neighborhoods in Brooklyn especially hard. The number of foreclosures and abandoned properties has soared, but one housing program known as the Nehemiah Homes has amassed a strong record of keeping people in their homes, and it's done so, imagine this, by carefully vetting each and every borrower. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Yvonne Ziegler was living in an apartment in a housing project when she heard about the Nehemiah Homes. She had a good office job and she made enough to get by, but like a lot of New Yorkers, she figured she'd be renting forever.
I didn't have the aspirations that I could afford a house. So when it came to light that these churches were building affordable houses and how low the mortgages were, I thought, well, maybe this is something I can aspire to do.
A few years ago, she made the down payment on a three-bedroom house where she lives today with her mother. The program that built her house was started in the 1980s by a coalition of Brooklyn churches and synagogues and named for the biblical prophet Nehemiah, who rebuilt the Temple of Jerusalem. Bishop David Banke of St. Peter's Lutheran Church says at the time, whole blocks of Brooklyn had been wiped out by arson and neglect. But a core of working people remained, and Nehemiah figured that turning them into homeowners would help restore the neighborhood.
The idea of Nehemiah was to afford an opportunity for people to own homes in areas of the city that were devastated. And that meant to rebuild them from scratch, and that the people who were going to build these homes were going to be the people who had some skin in the game.
Today, Nehemiah has built more than 4,000 houses on streets like this one. The houses are trim and modest. The words cookie cutter come to mind. But they've provided a bulwark of stability against blight, and that's been especially true lately. Nehemiah officials say a tiny handful, no more than 10 of the houses they've built, have faced foreclosure. This in a part of the city where foreclosures topped 10% last year. The low default rate has much to do with the high hurdles the applicants have to jump over. One recent evening, a handful of Nehemiah homeowners gathered to talk about the program. Zandra Brockman says when she signed up for Nehemiah, she knew nothing about buying a home. The program schooled her in concepts like home equity and amortization.
There were certain guidelines, and then there were certain tests that we had to take to get us prepared to be a homeowner. Because this is an investment. They didn't just want anybody to come in, and you wasn't aware on what you had to do to be a homeowner.
Nehemiah meticulously vetted the finances of would-be homeowners. Buyers' monthly mortgage payments couldn't exceed about 20% of their income. Again, Yvonne Ziegler.
The credit check that I had to go through Nehemiah was much more extensive than through a regular credit check. They constantly monitored where you got your money from, how long your money was in the bank. If you made a deposit over $1,000, you had to prove where you got it from.
A lot of people who applied for the program were turned down at first, says Sarah Plowden, but they would come back and try again. They'd clean up their credit records and start saving for a down payment. And Plowden says as often as not, they would reapply and get accepted.
Well, I was really proud of to know that so many of our people had worked to make sure that they were legitimate. You know, it could say, I can put my name on my credit history. I can put my name on this document and nothing won't come up later on me. So a lot of things came out. We more than just bought homes. We bought into one another as a people.
Plowden says over the years, some people have chafed at the restrictions that Nehemiah imposes. Because of the tough credit and income standards, a lot of low-income people can't qualify. But Alyssa Katz, author of the book Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us, says Nehemiah has also made home ownership possible for a lot of people who could not otherwise afford it. She says that's partly because Nehemiah built homes on land abandoned to the city, so it could price houses very cheaply.
Look at what it actually did. It brought the entry price into home ownership down to a level that working people could afford in a very, very expensive city, where people who make modest incomes invariably rent.
Then, too, the restrictions that the program imposes on applicants have to be put in context. The kind of thorough vetting that Nehemiah puts applicants through used to be standard procedure. The mortgage market changed, but Nehemiah never did, and that's why it's escaped the subprime crisis largely unscathed. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. For the next few minutes, we are going to talk about money. We'll talk about the latest round of Wall Street bonuses. Goldman Sachs is poised to pony up $23 billion to its executives. What did they do to earn all that? We'll ask. But first, we turn to our money coach, Alvin Hall, about a money issue that will hit close to home for many recent college graduates. Earlier this summer, thousands of college grads donned their robes and put on their mortarboards only to face a barren job market. Now it's fall, which means many of those grads will have to face something else, their first student loan payments. The six-month grace period on student loans for the class of 2009 is about to expire. But what do you do if you still haven't landed a job? We'll ask Alvin Hall, our regular contributor on matters of personal finance and the economy. He joins us from our studios in New York. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
I'm very glad to be here. This is a topic that I've been talking a lot about lately.
So what should you do if your first student loan payment comes due and you don't have a job and the bank of mom and dad is kind of tight too?
Get on the phone with your lender as soon as possible. Talk to a real person. Explain your situation to them. And generally, they are very kind and open. I've been dealing with two friends who have exactly this problem. And when they approached the two lenders, both of them said, fine, we can extend this for another 6 months or 9 months. So they gave them forbearance during this period of time.
Now, are these loans issued through the government or were they issued through private lenders? And is there a difference in the standard for getting additional forbearance?
These loans were all made by the government through banks, and because it's the government has greater latitude. When it's a private loan, you're either dealing with an individual or a consortium of individuals who really are making that loan either looking for cash flows or out of altruism. And negotiating those loans or forbearance on those can be a little bit more tricky.
Let me just ask, though, this. Do you have a right to forbearance after 6 months if you are unemployed or you have other pressing financial circumstances like medical bills, or is this optional? Is this up to the lender?
From everything I've read, it appears to be up to the lender, but it's becoming a widespread benefit that they offer everybody. I think the lenders really know that people are having a hard time, and it's not in their benefit at all to put black marks on people's credit rating to make them look terrible. After all, the people invested in themselves, and if the lenders can help them pay off the loans or find reasonable ways to do that, then when the people start to earn money, they will view this as a positive and live up to their obligations.
Is there some documentation that you would have to provide to demonstrate your financial circumstances? Or do you think your self-reporting is enough to say, I continue to be unemployed and therefore I can't pay this back? Or I have some other circumstances like medical bills or something else?
That's a very, very good question. In all the cases I've seen lately, the people simply called up on the phone, dealt with a real person. The person asked them a couple of questions. Have you been looking for work? How much money are you earning if you're working part-time? And they took their word for it and gave them a year in one case, not having to make any payments on that loan. So I've not seen a case in my own personal experience where they had to provide the document. On the other hand, another friend of mine said that his situation was a little bit more difficult because he had lost his job and they wanted to ask him, what happened? How did you lose your job? What were you earning before? Did you have any savings? But still, they arranged for him to have a period when he would not have to make any loan payments.
So let's say people disregard your advice and just chuck the bill in the trash can, just saying, look, I just can't deal with this right now. What are the consequences for that, saying the heck with it?
That's so wrong. Putting your head in the sand, acting like an ostrich about this is just the complete wrong action. First of all, you will go delinquent. Then you'll default on the loans. Then the lender has no other choice but to notify the credit agency about this and then to pursue you. Your best action is to be proactive. Let them know what's going on with your employment or lack of employment. Let them know if you have medical bills. Keep them informed and they will work with you. I know of so few cases in my own experience and those of the circle of friends where proaction has not resulted in a decent solution.
And finally, we keep hearing about the credit crunch, which remains real.
It's real.
For particularly, you know, for individual consumers, for small businesses. What about the student loan situation? Let's say you haven't finished your education. What is the availability right now of student loans for people who are still in school?
The government is trying to make loans available because they recognize that the next generation also will need even more education than the current generation, given the globalization of the world. So I tell everybody, if you're applying to college or university, one of the first things you need to say to that admission director is, let me talk to the financial aid director at the school. Tell them the truth of your situation. And generally, again, they will try to work with you to put together a series of loans, grants, and other funding sources that will help you avoid coming out of school with this onerous amount of debt. And if this school can't do it for you, look at another school. I tell people today, it's good to have one or two options if you're looking for funding, because one school may not have the resources or the depth of experience to give you that information.
Alvin, just to tie a bow on our conversation about student loans, how long can you continue to ask for forbearance on repaying student loans, assuming that your job situation remains precarious or you have other sort of pressing financial concerns?
One friend of mine has had it for up to 3 years. He has occasionally made loan payments over that period of time when he was working, but this is his third forbearance. Another situation I know, they have had it for 2 years, and finally, they cannot get another extension at all.
Well, it's our understanding that one can apply for up to 36 months of forbearance on government-sponsored student loans at least. But from what you're telling us is that the loans issued through private lenders may have different...
Shorter time period.
So it's best to check. But I guess your word of wisdom, Alvin, is don't throw the envelope in the drawer.
Don't throw it in the drawer. Be proactive. Call the lender. Talk to a real person. Get them on your side. And generally, they will be so warm and gracious to you. They're not your adversary. They're your friend to help you find a solution to this problem.
Alvin Hall is Tell Me More's regular contributor on matters of personal finance and the economy. He joined us from our studios in New York. Thanks, Alvin.
You're most welcome.